I'm going to talk today about the effectiveness of direct action as a strategy and tactic. And I guess the reason that I'm even here, why me, right, is just because back in the early 80s, which is quite a while ago now, there was a group of people who came out of the prisoner, abolition, anarchist, environmental, third world support groups, and we formed like this underground guerrilla group and called ourselves Direct Action, and we did a bombing of the Lytton plant and a substation in Vancouver Island and some red hot videos in Vancouver, and then we eventually got arrested and I was in prison for a number of years, and so I think that's why. And then I've been active in the prison abolition movement, if you want to call it that, for a number of years now. But anyways, I think it's really important that people speak up today about direct action, especially, you know, in this climate where the United States is waging this war against so-called terrorism, because if we continue to, you know, remain marginalized and silent, then, you know, they can pretty much carry on their campaign without a whole lot of resistance. And I think it's especially important here in North America that we realize that so much of the violence that the Americans military is carrying out, that we are the ones that are most capable actually of stopping it, is actually here in the, you know, in the homeland of the multinational corporations. It's particularly important that we speak up because, you know, this is a really major campaign that they're waging against liberation movements, resistance movements, you know, internal resistance. And they're going to be obviously including people, you know, in this country who are involved in direct action as well in their campaign. And of course, I think most people here are aware that, you know, we're living in the 1984 world that George Orwell described, and are living in within the language of doublespeak. You know, like when they talk about, you know, the war against terrorism using September 11th as an excuse, we pretty much have to redefine all these words. Because, like I said, I think most of the people that they're targeting are mainly resistance and liberation movements, and I think the American military would like to arrest history at September 11th. But if we look back to the beginning of, when the American imperialism really gained strength after the Second World War, I think that they pretty much own the word terrorism. When you look at if you define terrorism as attacks against civilians, I mean, the two nuclear bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki killed 200,000 civilians. In the Vietnam War, there were about 2 million civilians that were killed, and the American military under General Haig gave the Israelis the green light in 1982 to invade Lebanon, where 17,500 Palestinians were killed. I think historically that the Americans in their military campaigns, in their slaughter of civilians, far outweighs any killing of civilians that has occurred through liberation movements, and we have to keep that in mind. And also, the reasoning behind these campaigns is always we're fighting for democracy and freedom. But once again, we have to look at history, and there's example time and again where these campaigns are really for the freedom of capitalism, you know, to continue to operate all over the world with impunity. Back in 1949, there was a democratically elected government in Syria that the CIA helped to overthrow. 1953, again, the CIA helped to overthrow a democratically elected government in Iran and helped to prop up the Shah, who I think was in government for something like 20 years. Obviously, 1973, most people are pretty aware of Salvador Allende being overthrown by Pinochet. Once again, the CIA, this could not have occurred if they had not been helping them militarily. And, of course, the American CIA has always been behind the different sort of vigilante forces in South America, you know, the Contras in Nicaragua and the death squads. in El Salvador. So anyways, so what is direct action and what is terrorism then? In my definition, direct action can encompass a whole lot of different actions and everything from, you know, a particular lifestyle to, you know, people who are, let's say, their talent is music, workers' cooperatives, organized people that are doing community organizing, all the way up to the more militant forms of direct action where people are engaging in economic sabotage. And I think that there's many different shades of gray when we speak of direct action. It's not just a black and white thing like the mass media would like us to believe. It's either, you know, in the mass media, it's either nonviolent or it's like armed struggle. Like, I mean, there's a whole gray area of direct action. And I think what defines direct action are the principles behind it. And again, you know, this can be a subject of debate, but I think that just even two basic principles, and one in my mind would be that people engaged in direct action are revolutionaries in the sense that they are not attempting to create social change by appealing to vanguards or political or economic elites. They're trying to create alternative organizations where power is as decentralized as practically possible, and that they hold in common a respect for life, meaning the environment and animals, the diversity of cultures and nationalities, you know, the right for all these people to live, you know, with their differences. And that is, I think, what defines direct action. A lot of people back in the 80s, we burned down some video stores that were selling very violent pornography, and I've had a lot of people say to me, well, what's different, what makes that any different, let's say burning down one of those stores from people who burn down abortion clinics. That's a very classic argument, and I think it's really simplistic that's where this idea of principles comes into mind. Like, I'm sure a lot of people here are involved in the anti-globalization movement, and you'll get cops that'll also be trashing windows. And a lot of people will try to discredit the anti-globalization, let's say the black bloc, because they'll say, well, look at who knows who's cops and who's not. But it's not just a matter, to me, of the action. It's the principles behind it. And otherwise, you could say that, let's say, all demonstrations are wrong, because fascists organize demonstrations. Does that mean that they're all wrong? And I guess I am a believer in just war. I mean, again, that's such a big topic, but I do think that there are cases where people do, a population does have to fight against an aggressor. And so, again, I could go on and on, but I don't think that we can just, divorce the action from the politics. And obviously, when you come down to the anti-globalization thing, if there are cops involved trying to infiltrate, inevitably they're going to start doing things that don't adhere to the principles because they couldn't possibly believe in them, or they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. And it will come out in the long run who exactly they are working for. And if they do continue to work in harmony with the protesters, well, all power to them, you know, as long as they're not getting any information from anybody. But anyways, so then what is terrorism? In my mind, terrorism is when our political actions that are focused on mainly civilians, where, you know, by definition of the word. And I think It's a difficult thing because nowadays we do see suicide bombings going on. And so I know this is very controversial probably for me to say, especially in a, you know, open audience, but I don't believe in I think that terrorism is something that that people engage in only as a last resort. And so I can't condemn it absolutely blanket across the board, but I think that it's the kind of political tactic that should only be used when there are no more resorts. And here in North America, I think we still do have enough space to engage in other forms of activity. And I'm only qualifying that because, you know, in cases like the Palestinians, where I think that's a whole different topic, we have a situation there where people are right up against a wall. You know, they have no room at all, in my opinion. And I'm not going to get into a big, long rap about that. But the reason that I wouldn't advocate a strategy or tactic of terrorism in North America at this point is because I think that the global economy is fueled by multinational corporations. I think that they are the driving force, unfortunately, at this point in human history. They are the ones that are determining history until we change that situation. They reduce all life, I believe, on this earth to its economic value, the environment, animals, women, children, everything. And their main, the thing that drives them is obviously, you know, the economy, is money, is profit. And I don't think that multinational corporations are, as an entity, are concerned about life. If they were, they would have policies that reflected this. I mean, time and time again, when you look at huge multinational corporations like the oil companies, if you want to just use Canada as an example, you know, they have these sour gas, they have these oil wells out in Alberta releasing sour gas, you know, which destroys the environment, kills livestock and people. And that's just one example. We could use Shell Oil in Nigeria as well. But Glaxo in South Africa, I mean, I think most people understand the concept that most multinational corporations don't make decisions based on perpetuating life. Their decisions are based on profits and on getting the most amount of money for their shareholders. And so I think that logically, again, when people are using direct action, there's community organizing and everything else. But when we talk about the most militant forms, let's say, or even in terms of educational organizing, what hurts the multinational corporations the most is when their assets, their profit making, is hindered. And I don't think that, for instance, even a CEO, let's say a CEO has a change of heart and decides that maybe we should sign the Kyoto Accords. You know, he's a little concerned about his grandchildren for some reason. But I think that if he did continue on this course, he would soon lose his job because the other executives, boards of directors, even the shareholders are going to go, hey, you know, we're going to lose a bit of money here, and we're not going to be making so much profit. And they, you know, so in other words, I think that as an entity, even let's say, like campaigns of terrorism at this point in time, unless there's absolutely no other choice, people wouldn't care if this CEO disappeared that much because there would be others that would replace him. And they don't care about their workers that are working in their buildings. Or they would be paying, especially the people that they're employing to build, let's say, their sneakers and that, they would be giving them fair living wages. So I think that it's not an effective strategy. I think effective strategies are geared towards making their investments less secure, their profits, you know, also less secure, to be going after the corporation's economic ability to function. And I think that most people involved in direct action don't see this kind of approach as being violent, which I share that view. I don't think that property, if it's being used by corporate entities to destroy the environment, to jeopardize life, that, let's say, breaking windows or if a building is no longer functional, I don't think those things have feelings or a future. Or children, or anything. And I think that when you look at, let's say Nike, for instance, you know, there's a big splash in the newspaper when a protester smash a window, let's say, in a Nike store. There's a, you know, big deal is made of this, and it's always the word violence is used. But then, in little tiny print somewhere, they'll write about the people that they're employing, I don't know, in Thailand and are being paid below living standard wages. They've got people in there who actually are violently threatening people who try to organize unions. The working conditions kill people. And they use all those profits to market running shoes to poor people, you know, $100 running shoes, which loving parents will buy for their children to avoid having them bullied at school because these children have been so indoctrinated with being cool. Like if they don't have these running shoes, you know. Now to me, that is a very conscious campaign, and its end result is clearly violent. Whereas I don't think that breaking that Nike window is. Now, you know, I'm not here to sort of advocate what, you know, an urban guerrilla campaign or anything. But I do think, and I do think that our movement has to be as flexible and accommodating as possible. I'm not trying to, when I say capitalism is, I'm not trying to say we should be like capitalists, but in a sense, capitalism is a very flexible and accommodating economy. And on that level, I think that the direct action movement should be very flexible and accommodating as long as people are, you know, sticking to the basic principles that we believe in, and should be willing to, you know, there should be the diversity, you know, I think so many people, we've talked about this so much, and the different areas for people to plug in depending on their particular life, and that involves supporting the militant people as well as the people who are engaged in the more peaceful or civil disobedience aspects of it. But when it comes right down to it, we cannot, I personally do not believe we can do enough. Although we do have to choose tactics and strategies that are effective. I mean, I think people have always been using the thing of, oh, the world's coming to an end. But I think that it actually, you know, I think it's more and more of the sort of status quo, you know, educated elite are beginning to say the same thing, you know. Since the Second World War, thermonuclear war has truly jeopardized the existence of the planet. And I think, you know, global warming. We've had, you know, there was something like 1,500 scientists that the United Nations hired, and they came out with the conclusion that global warming was going to have a catastrophic effect. You know, that we're producing twice as much CO2 as the planet can absorb, and on and on. So there is a certain urgency. So I do believe that we all have to, you know, push ourselves as far as we can, because, like I said, it is here in North America that it's important that we weaken imperialism. I should hurry up here and get to the end of this. One of the critiques of direct action in its most militant form is that it alienates people, and that, you know, like people who engage in militant direct action, you know, the general public, it causes them not to attend meetings or demonstrations, or, you know, they want to, you know, really divorce themselves from the issues. Well, I'm arguing today that that is not necessarily the case. Like, even in our particular example, which for a lot of people here was, you know, really a long time ago when people were just, you know, little children, but With the Lytton bombing, which was very controversial because unfortunately there were people injured, even then there was a long campaign to try to stop the Lytton plant from producing the guidance system for the cruise missile, and there were a lot of people involved in the civil disobedience movement against this. And then, it was bombed, and there were injuries at the Lytton plant as well. But despite that, 2 weeks after the bombing, they had the largest demonstration they'd ever had in Ottawa. There were 15,000 people there against the testing of the cruise missile here in Canada, because at that time Canada was being used as the testing grounds for the cruise missile. And then a month after the bombing, they had the largest demonstration and civil disobedience action at Lytton that had ever taken place. There were 700 people. Now, I'm not saying that that's because of the bombing, because it was obviously in large part because of the large, you know, popular campaign that had taken place, but I'm just saying that even the most extreme action did not alienate people from participating, from becoming involved. The Operation Dismantle tripled its membership in the year following the bombing. With the Red Hot Video firebombings, again, the women's community had been organizing ever since they came to Vancouver, showing some of the... these were not erotic or porno videos. They were, like, you know, very violent videos, which is another thing I could get into because that'll probably come up. But regardless of that, there were, you know, the police would not act when the women's community were lobbying for a year. Very popular, large numbers of women were involved in this movement. And the Attorney General's office in BC would not do anything about it. They wouldn't use the criminal code to shut them down. So when the Women's Fire Brigade burned down three of them, within a year, there was only one store left. Like, two of them moved out of the province for fear of being burned down. Some of them moved out and changed their names. And there was a very large support for this as well. There was a lot of, you know, a support in phone-in shows and letters to the editor. And on the day that we were arrested, the cops finally did actually charge. They raided a Victoria store and charged it with three counts of obscenity. But it took, you know, all of the support of the community for the firebombings, because I think that's what alarmed the police, was that, you know, people actually saw the women involved in the Women's Fire Brigade as being more effective than they were. And I think if we want to look at what's been going on more recently, before Seattle, the Anti-Globalized, the World Trade Organization Summit, I'm just getting really close to the end here, two more minutes, okay. Before the Anti-Globalization Summit demonstration in Seattle, there was an anti-globalization movement, but I don't think it was until, the demonstration in Seattle that all of a sudden everybody was aware of it, and, you know, and people that were at home talking about it over their dinner tables. And it seems that the numbers of people that have been turning up at the different global summits has really dramatically increased. And I'm sure that many of the average citizens who've never even been to a demonstration are aware now of what the WTO and the WB means and IMF, whereas I would be quite surprised if the average citizen was really aware of what these terms were before. So my point is that direct action can be effective in developing a social movement. And I'm just going to try to wrap this up here. I was going to say OCAP, I think, has served the same purpose in bringing the criminalization of the poor, of Mike Harris's government, to the public in general. Whether people like it or not, because of the actions of OCAP, people have started discussing it, thinking about it, and I think that, you know, anyways, I think that it can serve a purpose, so anyways, and that it can be effective. I could go on and on, but that'll be it, and we'll have a discussion, I guess.